This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, analysis of U.S. President Barack Obama's historic trip to Cuba.
I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas. I have come here to extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people.
And with those words, President Barack Obama acknowledged the difficult history between the United States and Cuba, but also offered a message of peace to the Cuban people as he neared the end of his landmark visit to the communist country. He is the first sitting U.S. president to visit the island nation, just 145 kilometers off the coast of Florida, in almost 9 decades. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Addressing the Cuban people from the Palace of the Revolution in Havana, President Obama also called for an end to the decades-old U.S. economic embargo on Cuba, calling it an outdated burden on the Cuban people.
As President of the United States, I have called on our Congress to lift the embargo. It is an outdated burden on the Cuban people. It's a burden on the Americans who want to work and do business or invest here in Cuba. It's time to lift the embargo.
But in the same address, President Obama also forcefully criticized the Cuban government, saying even if the embargo were lifted, the Cuban people would still not be able to live up to their potential without democratic reforms.
I believe that every person should be equal under the law. Every child deserves the dignity that comes with education and health care and food on the table and a roof over their heads. I believe citizens should be free to speak their mind without fear, to organize and to criticize their government and to protest peacefully, and that the rule of law should not include arbitrary detentions of people who exercise those rights. I believe that every person should have the freedom to practice their faith peacefully and publicly. And yes, I believe voters should be able to choose their governments in free and democratic elections.
President Obama speaking to the Cuban people during his historic trip to the island nation. Well, for more on the substance and politics of normalizing relations with Cuba, we turn to two distinguished Latin American scholars. William Leo Grand is professor of government at American University and author of several books on U.S.-Cuba relations, including Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, and Ian Vasquez. He is director of the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity at the Cato Institute, that's a libertarian think tank based here in Washington. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Professor Leo Grand, let me begin with you to talk about the trip, the timing and substance. The United States and Cuba announced they would restore ties back in December 2014. Since then, diplomatic relations have been restored. And now, what is your reaction to the timing and the results of President Obama's trip?
So I think the reason the president decided to go now rather than waiting until later this year is because he still has 10 months now for his administration to try to use the momentum caused by the presidential trip to actually make some substantive progress in the bilateral relationship. There are a large number of negotiations underway between U.S. and Cuban diplomats on a wide range of issues of mutual interest and issues in which we're in disagreement. And I think that the president is hoping that his trip will energize that diplomatic process so that by the end of his term, he will have been able to demonstrate that the new policy shows result and therefore create an environment in which the policy is, as Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes said, irreversible.
Turning to you, Ian Vasquez, for your interpretation of the timing and the substance of this trip.
I think that whoever comes after President Obama is likely not going to be as enthusiastic a supporter of this policy, but it will be much more difficult for that new president to try to reverse things even if they wanted to. But it looks like whatever new administration comes in will likely continue with this kind of policy, and that's certainly something that President Obama has in mind. And all in all, I think that's good for U.S. relations for Cubans and for U.S. relations in the region.
Turning to you again, Professor Leo Grand, notwithstanding the rather cautiously optimistic responses by both of you, there are certainly critics here in the United States, particularly prominent Cuban-American Congresswoman Ileana Ros-Lehtinen of Florida. She says that the Castro regime has already stated that it will not change one bit after so many U.S. concessions. She decries the lack of reciprocity. What do you say to what is perceived by those who oppose this new policy, that there's an imbalance in the trade-off, that Cuba is getting much more than the United States is getting in return?
Well, I think that's not correct. If we go back to the agreement that was announced on December 17th in 2014, the United States got the release of Alan Gross, the release of an important asset of our intelligence community who'd been in prison in Cuba for almost 20 years, the release of 53 political prisoners, and a commitment on Cuba's part to expand internet access across the island. So that's not nothing. Since then, we've restored diplomatic relations, but diplomatic relations is not a favor we do for another country. It involves mutual reciprocal interests, and today our diplomats can travel around Cuba and engage with Cuban society and understand how Cubans are living all across the island, which is something they could not do previously. The kind of regulatory changes the president has made have freed up travel to Cuba. That is a right of the American people to be able to travel freely. So that's not a concession that we've somehow made to Cuba. The relaxation of some of the commercial restrictions, again, is a benefit to American business. So I think all the things that the president has done thus far and all the things that have come out of the negotiations with Cuba are by their very nature reciprocal and in the interests of both countries, or else they wouldn't have been done.
Turning back to you, Ian Vasquez, for your take on the critics' take, so to speak, on President Obama's opening and then, of course, this trip, that they're still not convinced that this is in the best interest of the United States. We're not getting enough in return from Cuba.
Well, I take the criticisms seriously, even if I don't fully agree with them. It is true that the regime has a lot more that it could do. It is true that it has gone backward on a lot of things recently, including more arbitrary detentions and repression of human rights activists. And it is true that there still is very little freedom on the island. But I think that we have to get away from this notion in the United States that somehow it is up to Washington to control events in other countries, and that it has, in addition, the ability to do so through unilateral policy. I think that, if anything, the past 50-some years of its relationship with Cuba shows that ability is very limited. And I would like to be able to see much more progress, but the U.S. simply is limited in its ability to promote these things. And so we should become more realistic and also, I think, more consistent with our foreign policy in the sense that we have diplomatic relations and trade ties with regimes all around the world, many of whom are very unsavory regimes, dictatorships, Russia, China, regimes all over the Middle East. Is it really realistic to think that the world would be better off with U.S. embargoes against much of the world? No, I don't think so. And I don't think that Cuba should be treated differently.
Well, turning back to you, Professor Leo Grand, to talk about the political problems in Cuba that bother many people, particularly the Cuban-American community. Now, President Obama said that the United States and Cuba cannot fully normalize relations if the Castro regime does not improve its record on human rights. He said, even in his speech, that this is not just a policy of normalizing relations with the Cuban government, but the United States is normalizing relations with the Cuban people. Do you think that the lack of progress on human rights and greater liberty is a mere irritant or a much more formidable obstacle to deeper engagement?
Well, I think there's no doubt that the issue of human rights has been on the president's agenda from the beginning. He's had now three face-to-face conversations with Raul Castro, and in every one of them, he has raised the issue of human rights. And in every public statement about this policy of normalization, he has reaffirmed his commitment and his administration's commitment. Of the many dialogues underway between U.S. and Cuban diplomats, one of them is a human rights working group that's trying to engage some of these issues. It's tough because, as we heard in the exchange at the press conference between the president and Raul Castro, our two countries have very different conceptions of human rights, and the Cubans focus on social and economic rights and subordinate political rights to those, whereas here in the United States, I think it's fair to say we have the reverse situation. We put a premium on political liberties and civil rights, and social and economic rights are something we strive for, but we don't see as necessarily a right of everyone. So that's going to be a long and difficult conversation, as it is with countries like China, as it is with countries like Vietnam. But it doesn't mean that we can't have a policy of engagement with those countries that serves the interests of the United States.
Turning back to you, Ian Vasquez, and let me put the same question to you. Do you think that the lack of progress on human rights and greater liberty in Cuba is a mere irritant, so to speak, or a formidable obstacle to deeper engagement?
Well, I think it's correct for President Obama to clearly state his support for human rights and for greater freedom. That's about as good as a president can get in trying to promote these ideas. Beyond that, there's not all that much the United States or the U.S. government can do to change a regime that is decidedly against increasing freedom. I do think, however, that what President Obama did goes a long way. He went to Havana, he gave a speech that the Cuban people listened to, and said things that the Cuban people agreed with, and he flustered in front of the entire country the president, and I should just call him a leader because he's not actually a president, the dictator of Cuba. When the issue of human rights came up, when the issue of political prisoners came up, he played that card very well, and all of Latin America saw that. It made the entire trip worth it.
Let me just add, if I might, on this issue, Ian is correct that the Cuban government has not changed its behavior with regard to the short-term detention of dissidents as they demonstrate every Sunday. And on that score, it's not any more tolerant than it was a year ago or 2 years ago. But if we understand human rights as broader than just the treatment of demonstrators and dissidents, if we think of it as including the right to own a business, the right to travel abroad, the right to practice your religion, the right to access the internet or own a computer or a cell phone or sell or buy a house or write critical articles about the government in a blog or a magazine or in your music or in your art, I think those are all threads in the broader tapestry of human rights. And on each of those areas, the situation in Cuba has actually improved in the last few years. And I think that President Obama's opening to Cuba deserves some of the credit for that.
Would you agree, Ian,
with respect definitely. To... Yes, definitely. I think that all of those indicators are indicators of greater freedom, even if they're on the margin, even if it's too early to tell how far of an influence that will have on the island. But clearly, the fact that there are now hundreds of thousands or more than before tourists coming to the island means that there's a lot more interaction of free people. This has a couple of implications. One is not only that the visitors are interacting with the official Cuban economy, but definitely it is increasing the informal sector, as in all parts of Latin America. And this has the effect of not only giving ordinary Cubans a little bit more income for themselves, but creating greater independence from the state. And I think that that's something that we can expect will continue to increase, but especially when Americans begin to travel more, because as we know, Americans tend to be more philanthropic than most other citizens of the world, and they're going to have a much bigger presence than before.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are William Leo Grand, he's professor of government at American University, and Ian Vasquez, from whom you just heard, he's director at the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity at the Cato Institute, and that's a libertarian think tank based here in Washington. We're discussing the implications of President Barack Obama's historic trip to Cuba. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Diana Pinto. She's a loyal listener of Cuban descent. Well, back to you, Professor Leo Grandin. Let's go to another major sticking point, and that is, of course, the embargo. The Congress has to lift the embargo. The president can't do that by executive action. What are the prospects, in your view, of the next Congress taking up and actually lifting the embargo, and how much of a difference would that make in not only our trading relationship, but also could the Castro regime still keep a lid on political dissent as easily once the embargo is lifted.
So I think there's actually a reasonable chance that the Congress might lift the embargo next year after we get past the election, especially if there's a Democrat in the White House who is a strong supporter of moving forward with the president's policy of engagement. There are probably already enough votes in the Senate, even today, to lift the embargo if you had a floor vote. In the House of Representatives, there are a number of Republican members who are pro-business and are beginning to hear from their business constituents that they want to get into the Cuban market. So I think next year, some of these issues are definitely going to come to the floor, and it's very possible that we could see a breakthrough. Now, as to how much difference it'll make, I think it will make a big difference. President Obama has punched a number of holes in the embargo using his licensing authority, but it's still difficult for U.S. firms to invest in Cuba. Only in very few cases of investment have been approved, and it is virtually impossible for a Cuban state enterprise to export anything to the United States. And of course, we still have the ban on simple tourism in place. So an American citizen can't go to Cuba and just lie on the beach. If the embargo were lifted tomorrow, it would take away one of the Cuban government's main excuses for its economic problems, which is that the United States has this set of economic sanctions, the most severe sanctions we have against any country in the world. You know, Fidel Castro, when he was president, was a master at wrapping himself in the Cuban flag and mobilizing Cuban nationalism against the United States. And we made the mistake for many years of providing him with a perfect adversary that he could exploit. I think it will be more difficult for the Cuban government to contain expanding freedom of expression, expanding demands for information and connectivity when it can no longer point to the United States as a national security threat. And that, in my judgment, is one of the reasons that the president began his speech to the Cuban people by saying he had come to end the Cold War in the Caribbean and the United States was no longer a threat to Cuba.
Well, turning to you, Ian Vasquez, for your take on whether or not the Congress will lift the embargo anytime soon. Do you agree with Professor Liogrand that it's very possible that after the election, whether a Democrat or Republican becomes president, that there are enough votes to lift the embargo? And then secondly, how much of a difference do you think it would make, not only in our trading relationship, but also could this be one of those situations where be careful what you wish for, where the Castro regime is asking, yes, you have to lift the embargo, demanding that this be done, but if they do, perhaps they may regret it because it could be an impetus for greater liberty?
Yes, I think that it is possible for the Congress to begin lifting the embargo. They've already shown that they're interested in doing so. The politics in the United States has changed quite a bit in the past 5 years, where you have Republicans and Democrats from states that export agriculture and other goods. They're interested in ending the embargo, and you have sentiment in the United States, public opinion, that no longer sees any usefulness for the embargo, even among the Cuban-American community, and that's important. So I think that that's something that's realistic. As far as the impact of lifting the embargo on Cuba, on human rights and other realities within the island, I think we should have realistic expectations about how much more economic activity and trade will result. After all, this is a communist country. It has some of the worst economic policies in the world. And you don't have much trade with countries that are basket cases, which is what Cuba is. And until and unless it actually starts reforming those policies, we're not going to see this huge boom in economic activity, this huge boom in growth. So that's one of the reasons why I favor ending the embargo, because it will clarify precisely what the source of the problems are, the source of the low growth, the source of the poverty, and the source of the misery in Cuba. It does take away that excuse for the regime. And I think that that's probably the best argument to show the world that the focus should be on domestic Cuban policies that need to change.
Well, that's a very interesting point. Well, back to you, Professor Liogrand, to talk about the politics here in the United States, to what extent they have changed. For years, we've known that, in a way, U.S.-Cuban relations were really a domestic issue, where you have the state of Florida, a very important electoral state, which, of course, has the largest community of Cuban Americans. And up until recently, those emigres were opposed to the opening. How do you see the Cuban American community today? Are there generational divides, more perhaps in favor of the opening than fewer?
There's no doubt the Cuban American community has evolved over time, and its attitudes have changed fairly dramatically. If you go back to the early 1990s, when Florida International University began doing a regular poll in the Cuban American community in South Florida, 80% of respondents wanted to keep the embargo in place and were opposed to any kind of engagement with Cuba, not even selling food or medicine to the island. But that's gradually changed over time to the point where today a majority of Cuban Americans in South Florida actually support what the president has done and support lifting the embargo. The reason for that attitudinal change is really a demographic evolution in the community. Cuban Americans who came in the 60s and 70s were political exiles, and they objected to the socialist communist direction of the revolution. They lost everything. They gave up everything to come to the United States. But Cuban Americans who've come more recently, especially since the end of the Cold War, tend to be coming more for economic than political reasons. They've maintained connections with their family on the island. They send them remittances. They travel back and forth. And for those Cuban Americans, a normal state-to-state relationship is a good thing because it enables them to stay in touch with their family back home. And so you'll see that Cubans who came after 1980, and especially after 1990, tend to be, in the vast majority, in favor of engagement with Cuba and in favor of what the president has done. Also, now, today, the largest bloc in the community and the largest bloc in the Cuban-American electorate are Cuban-Americans born in the United States, and they, too, have a much more moderate view of what U.S.-Cuban policy should be. So what this means is that Cuban policy is no longer the third rail of Florida politics, and it becomes possible for a president to change the policy, as President Obama has done, and not lose Florida in the next presidential election.
Well, turning to you, Ian Vasquez, for your take, as Professor Leo Grand said, do you think we've arrived at the day where Cuban policy is no longer the third rail of U.S. politics? That is, do you see the same demographic changes where in Florida, Cuban Americans, the majority are in favor of a change of the diplomatic relations?
Yeah, I think there's a big demographic difference. Cuban Americans that were born here, just as Professor Leo Grand said, a lot of these younger generations of Cubans have grown up seeing how ineffective the policies toward Cuba have been at promoting human rights, at promoting democracy, at promoting economic reform, at dislodging the Castro regime. It's been completely ineffective, and they don't have the same emotional and sentimental ties as the generations that came before them. And I think that that's another reason why, when people today, after barely a year in the change in policy, say that, well, the regime is still violating human rights, that criticism doesn't go very far among a lot of people, and I think with reason. I mean, for 50-some years, that was going on with a policy that wasn't working. This policy has barely started, and it's not having a huge effect in that regard. I don't know for the critics how much time they want to give it, but maybe we should try 50 years to be even. The point is that it shows, once again, there are real limits to what the United States can do to change the reality of a hardline Stalinist regime. As I say, what's true in Cuba is true in every country. What determines a country's progress and growth and dynamic is domestic policies and institutions in the medium and in the long term. That's true in Cuba, too. And outside factors like the weather, like geography, like what the United States wishes or doesn't wish, aren't the factors that determine those things. And so on the margins, I think that ending the embargo, more engagement, more travel by Americans can have an effect that's positive and that provides more pros than cons.
All right, on that relatively optimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, William Leo Grand, he's professor of government at American University, and Ian Vasquez, director at the Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity at the Cato Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Chiang Wong, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.